Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, pulpiteers, and welcome to issue 25 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that each week slips a 20 to Father Time so he'll let us duck back through the time stream to the golden age of pulp fiction and bring back one of the fabulous stories of the era and deliver it directly to your ears. I'm your host, Dave Robison. This week we bring you a tale of railroad intrigue titled Agent Andy by Russell A. Boggs, first published in Adventure Magazine on August 3, 1919. Russell A. Boggs was a railroader from Pennsylvania who wrote more than a dozen tales for various pulp magazines, including Top Notch, People's Magazine, and even the Saturday Evening Post. One of his stories, Dan Curie's Inning, was the basis for the screenplay of the movie Sand, produced in 1920. And here's an interesting tidbit about Adventure Magazine. In 1912, editor Arthur Sullivan Hoffman and his assistant, the author Sinclair Lewis, came up with the idea for an identity card with a serial number on it for their readers. If the bearer of the card was killed, someone finding the card would notify the magazine, who would in turn notify the next of kin of the ill-fated adventurer. The card was extremely popular among travelers and led to the formation of the Adventurers Club in New York. The original New York Adventurers Club led to similar clubs in Chicago, L.A., Copenhagen, and Honolulu. Your narrator for this week's tale is Tim Maroney. Now, you hear that? The ring of steel on steel? That's the railroad being built, opening the doors of fortune and prosperity across America. But there's some folks looking for a more immediate and underhanded fortune to be had.
Carrick, superintendent of the Northern Division of the RS&T Railroad, had the reputation of being an obstinate man, one difficult to persuade from any view but his own, and it was said of him that he never forgot anything, good or bad. This being the case, it is not strange that he should keep in mind the first dereliction of Andy Peck, agent at Bellum. It was in the spring of the year 1916 that Superintendent Carrick started out with the general manager and several general superintendents and a number of other officials of high and low degree on a trip of inspection. They came to Bellum on their special train and found the station locked and the agent absent. They waited and fussed about for the better part of 10 minutes, the general manager and the other high officials casting coldly questioning glances at the fuming Carrick and inquiring of one another, in distantly ominous voices, that they made certain the luckless superintendent would hear. What sort of a doings was this? But no agent came, and the inspection of the Bellum station was abandoned. The special rolled away with its indignant passengers. You may be sure that a subsequent investigation came. Oh, yes. And this investigation brought out the fact that while the high and mighty members of the inspection party were wasting a precious 10 minutes waiting in vain for Andy Peck to come and let them in so they could have a look-see, said Andy was calmly stretched out on the chair in a barber shop, several minutes' walk distant from the depot, receiving certain tonsorial attentions. "You kept us waiting for that?" stormed Carrick. "Kept us out while you got a shave and a haircut?" "And a shampoo," corrected young Andy with proper humility. His face was perfectly sober, though inwardly he was feeling somehow mighty pleased with himself. For this, you must understand, was before he had met Ina, the miller's daughter, and learned responsibility. "It's the most outrageous thing I ever heard of," gasped the superintendent, glaring. "Business was slack," murmured the wicked Andy. "And I didn't know you were coming," he sighed. "If only you'd given me word." Carrick glared some more. "Send word, indeed, and spoil the very purpose of the inspection?" "We'll see," he cried, and pounded the top of the desk. We'll lay you off for 30 days for this offense. And mind this, if ever again I find you absent from your office when you should be on duty, I'll discharge you completely. So Andy got his 30 days, and he didn't care. He enjoyed the enforced vacation, in fact. In those 30 days, he got properly acquainted with the folks of Bellumtown, to which he had but shortly come. And, best of all, he met black-eyed Ina, daughter of Duncan the Miller. The more he met Ina, the more Andy became convinced that this Bellum job was just the thing for him. And as the days passed, Ina came to agree with him. So by the time summer had gone and early fall had come, things between them were pretty well settled. "There's Lane's little bungalow," he said one evening. "It'll be empty the 1st of November." "Well," she hesitated, coloring prettily. "Set the day," he insisted. "Well, yes, all right." She placed her hand on his arm. "Just give me a day or two to decide, Andy," she said, just like a woman. But the very next afternoon, Superintendent Carrick dropped off a slowly moving freight as it passed Bellum Depot. He tried the waiting room door. It was unlocked, and he entered. He tried the office door. It was locked. He rattled the knob of the office door vigorously. No response. He peered in through the glass of the closed ticket window. No one in sight. He went outside and peered through the front office window, where he had a complete view of the interior. No person was within. "Aha," said Carrick, and went back into the silent waiting room and seated himself. A half hour passed. No agent. 45 minutes. Still no agent. The superintendent rose, stumped out of the building, and started to walk down the track. On a short siding just west of the station stood 6 camp cars, the quarters of the members of the steel gang, at present laying steel rail near Bellum, and all colored, brought from the south during the past summer. As Carrick was passing one of the cars, he heard voices speaking behind its closed doors. He paused.
"I don't know, Mr. Agent," said one speaker. "Steamboat, he say."
"Don't you listen to Steamboat," cut in the unmistakable voice of Agent Andy Peck. "You listen to me. I'm telling you the truth." Carrick waited for no more. He shoved open that door with a bang. Seated on the edge of a wooden bunk were 2 colored men, one with a bandaged foot, the other with a wrapped-up hand. On a soapbox opposite them sat Andy.
"Is this where you spend your time now?" asked Carrick grimly.
The agent looked a little dismayed. "I can explain," he began.
"Come out here," interrupted the superintendent. "I've something to say to you."
The agent descended from the car and followed Carrick. Out of earshot of the big-eyed colored men, the superintendent stopped and faced Peck. "You remember what I told you last spring?" he said firmly to the agent. "You've been absent from your office for at least 45 minutes this afternoon. I know, because I was at the station waiting. You're done. Fired."
"But you ought to let me explain," remonstrated Andy. "I was working for the interests of the RS&T when I was in that camp car just now."
"Likely," scoffed Carrick.
Peck flushed.
"Yes, sir," he affirmed steadily. "These steel gang boys are threatening to quit and go back south. They're worrying about the coming winter up north here. Afraid if they stay, they'll freeze. One of the gang is egging the others to go. A fellow they call Steamboat Jackson. I've been trying to queer his efforts and persuade them to stay. That's why I was talking to those 2 men when you came."
Carrick listened incredulously until Andy finished his tale.
"Bosh!" he snapped.
"It's the truth," declared Andy. He kept his mind fixed on Ina and thus was able to choke back the hot words that surged to his lips.
"No matter," said Carrick shortly. "I don't believe they'll leave. And even if they should, it's none of your affair. Your business was to stay in your office and take care of things there. Anyhow, you're done. I'll have a man here in a couple of days to relieve you."
Andy saw it was useless to talk any further to the headstrong superintendent.
"Very good," he said. Turning on his heel, he walked toward the depot.
2.
It was that very Thursday evening that Track Supervisor Quinn, of the Maintenance of Way Department, entered the superintendent's office at Horton, Division Headquarters, 20 miles east of Bellum.
"I don't know," said Quinn to Carrick abruptly, "but I'm afraid our colored steel gang is not going to stick with us. Now that there's a nip of frost in these fall mornings, they're getting restless. Their thoughts are turning back to their sunny south." Carrick looked up quickly. Recollection of what Agent Peck had said that afternoon flashed through his head.
"You think so?" he said, frowning.
Yes, returned Quinn. They've an exaggerated idea of the severity of our northern winter. That's one trouble. And another is that they're continually being stirred up by the more shiftless, restless spirits among them. By one man named Steamboat, especially. If we only could discreetly eliminate both troubles. More confirmation of what Peck had said. Carrick's face grew more dour. But no difference, he decided. Relief Agent Manette had already been instructed to relieve Peck the coming Monday. And anyway, these agents ought to learn their place. Peck had not been called on to take a hand with the Steel Gang. That agent at Bellum was saying something along that same line, he observed aloud, however. Andy Peck, said Quinn. Yes, he knows. Good boy. Been trying to keep him straight. It will be a little less than a calamity for us if we can't hold them, he went on, now that practically all the foreigners have gone back to the old countries to get in the big mix-up over there. And even those who didn't have entered the mills and factories, our last reserve, our last hope, is the colored labor from the south. You've said yourself that we absolutely must get this new rail laid to stand the heavy traffic that's coming this winter and next spring. The old steel that we're replacing is done for, as you know. If we should be compelled to try to make it stand up under the demand that will be made upon it, we're going to be left in a sad state. Carrick knew that this was sober truth. But he refused to be convinced that the Steel Gang situation was serious. It's probably just talk, he said. I don't believe they'll actually go. I'm afraid of it, persisted Quinn. However, I believe that if we could eliminate the uneasy element that keeps the others in a state of unrest, we could calm their fears about the coming cold weather. But the eliminating would have to be done in a most diplomatic manner. The whole gang is at the skittish point, ready to jump at the first move that looks suspicious to them. If we fire one and he goes, the entire crowd goes. That's the way I figure it. Well, said Carrick, what are you going to do about it? It was plain that he still was skeptical about the supervisor's fears. I'm stumped, said Quinn glumly. I'm worried sick about the whole business. He walked toward the door, and I'm expecting there'll be some sort of a crisis within the next few days, too. Oh, brother, said Carrick, it's probably nothing, but if you really are alarmed, do whatever you think best. I would, said Quinn, if I only knew what was best. I'm trying to think up something. He went out. Three. The Steel Gang was holding forth down at the far edge of the station platform, gathered in a ring at the edge of the circle of light made by the single platform lamp there. The early October moon tipped the eastern hills. The evening was still warm after the balmy, windless day. By morning, the colored men might be shivering under Jack Frost's caress, but tonight their hearts were light. The reason was simple. The coming Saturday, less than 48 hours away, would be payday. So now, this Thursday evening, by turns they clogged, bucking, winging with fantastic and grotesque shufflings of the feet, the onlookers applauding with boisterously enthusiastic cries. At frequent intervals, their voices rose in a song, wonderfully harmonious, vibrant with natural melody. Andy Peck, having nothing much to do just then, but wait until the last evening passenger train, number 73, should arrive, stood in the waiting room doorway for a time, dispiritedly watching the merrymaking down at the far end of the freight house. He certainly was feeling blue. After supper, he had stopped in at Duncan's before returning to the station. Ina had met him at the door. By his expression, she immediately perceived that he brought bad news. "Our wedding is off, for a while," he blurted out. "I've been fired." "Oh, Andy," she faltered. "How? Why?" Into her sympathetic ears, he quickly poured his sad tale. "The nasty old thing," she said indignantly when he had finished. "I'd just like to get my fingers in his hair a minute. I'd shake some sense into him." It is indicative of Andy's extreme misery that he did not even smile at that, the superintendent's crown being so devoid of hair that it would have been impossible to get anything approximating a grasp of it. "I was looking at Lane's bungalow, too," she continued, "just this afternoon. It's the dearest little house. She put her face close to his. Couldn't we be married anyway, Andy? We could, he replied, but we won't. Not till I get a job. You could find one afterward, she said. I'll find one first, he had answered, and forthwith he had torn himself away. For despite his firmness, he felt himself weakening, and that, he felt, was a poor thing to do under the circumstances. In consequence, Andy now brooded in the doorway of the station while he contemplated the lively steel gang. Presently he strolled down toward them, found a spike keg lying near the side of the freight house, upended it, and sat down just outside the circle of light. One, Memphis Joe, was performing at this time. Directly, Memphis, as he was called for short, cut a final figure in his clog and concluded his whirl. "Nuff!" he cried and dropped down against the freight house, close to where Andy sat. Cries now arose for "Steamboat! Steamboat!" Faces were turned expectantly toward the side of the ring, directly opposite the agent. "Get in, Steamboat! Hit her up! Shake them feet, Steamboat! Show us all what you got!" But Steamboat Jackson, burly and tall and extremely black, morosely shook his head. Of all the crowd, he was the single man, besides Andy, who appeared downhearted. "No, sir," he said, a trace of sullenness in his voice. "Come on, Steamboat, be a spoke." "No, sir," reiterated Steamboat. "Don't bother me." Thereupon, perceiving that Steamboat was not to be moved, another aspirant for acclaim stepped to the center. Agent Andy leaned over toward Memphis Joe. "What's the matter with Steamboat, Memphis?"
"Don't know, Mr. Agent. Steamboat, he's had a grouch on all day. He didn't go out with the gang. Didn't help lay no rail at all today."
"Sore at the foreman?"
Memphis Joe shook his head. "No, I don't think so. Don't know just what 'tis."
"Maybe he's worrying about the coming cold weather," suggested Andy. "Maybe he wants to travel south."
"That might be," agreed Memphis. "I heard him say no cold weather wasn't going to catch him up here. He's blowed that. When he did go south again, he's gone, well healed, with his pockets full enough to keep him that work until next spring."
"And he hasn't got the money yet, eh?"
"No, sir. Just this minute, I bet Steamboat ain't got enough in his jeans to take him halfway back to Vicksburg, where he came from."
"Well, day after tomorrow's payday," observed Andy. "He'll get some then."
"He'll draw about the same as me for the last 2 weeks," replied Memphis. "About $40. And $40 ain't going to keep no man over winter."
"That's right," assented Peck. "So then if Steamboat goes back soon, it looks like his blow was no good."
"Sure do. And say, boss, I hadn't thought of it much before, but I'll bet you have done hit it. I'll bet that's what is putting Steamboat in such a steady. He wants that money so he can hold up this winter down in Vicksburg, and he ain't got it. And what's more, he ain't liable to get it before cold weather comes, and when cold weather does come, he don't want to be here."
"I understand Steamboat wants the rest of you boys to go back with him," said Andy abruptly. Memphis shifted uneasily. "I heard some talk," he admitted. "Steamboat's been telling stuff." "He's talking through his hat," said Andy. And then, as Memphis kept silent, he added, "They tell me Steamboat is a bad actor when he gets going good." Memphis cast a wary glance at the sullen, glum Steamboat.
"'Deed, Mr. Agent, that's right. When Steamboat starts to spread himself, other folks just sort of ease back. They do it if they's wise."
Number 73's whistles sounded far up the track. Andy Peck rose from his keg. "Well, it looks like hard luck for Steamboat. I guess I'll have to stay here or else go on without his role." Memphis Joe also got up. He dropped his voice carefully. "It does," he agreed. "But I believe he's going to roll or no roll. I was only hoping, though, that if he does go, he goes without raising no ruckus like he done last payday. If he does start a ruckus, it's a dead show. All the rest of us colored boys going to leave, whether he was aiming to or not." Number 73's deep whistle drowned out any reply Andy might have attempted. He hurried toward his baggage truck. 4. On Friday afternoon, Steamboat Jackson, sprawled in the sunshine, just around a protected corner of the depot building, heard a rapid putt-putt up the tracks. A quick glance in that direction revealed to him that the sound was made by Supervisor Quinn's motor speeder as it swiftly drew nearer the station. Steamboat quickly decided it might not be best not to let the supervisor see him laying about the depot instead of being out laying rails with the rest of the steel gang. Not that Steamboat cared much, but it would save useless talk. At once the colored man rose and slunk around the back of the depot building, it being too late for him to regain the shelter of the string of camp cars that the steel gang used. He paused near the rear window of the agent's little office. The supervisor's speeder drew up to the station and stopped. Stepping off, Quinn lifted the wheels from the rails and rolled the speeder back from the tracks. Then he entered the station, going into the office where Andy Peck sat at his desk, completing his daily accounts. As the afternoon was rather warm, the agent had slightly raised the rear office window for ventilation. The voices of Peck and Quinn carried out clearly to the squatting Steamboat.
"Hello, Andy," said Quinn. "How are things today?"
"Poor," responded the agent.
"Rotten."
This was so different from the usually blithe Andy's speech that the supervisor stared in surprise.
"Why?" he exclaimed. "What's the trouble?"
"Ben Can," jerked out Andy.
"Yesterday.
By the right honorable Mr. Carrick. I'm waiting now for the relief man. Expect he'll be here about Monday."
"Tell me about it," pressed Quinn.
Peck did. When he was through, the supervisor whistled softly.
"The dickens," he said.
He was silent a moment. "Of course, I can't say much, but you know how I feel."
"Thanks," replied Andy.
"But let's talk about something else. What's on your own mind today?"
"Trouble, too," said Quinn. "Nothing but trouble. I'm trying to fix a way to get these steel gangers to stick with us. Foreman Walsh tells me there's open talk among the men that most of them are going to leave right after they get their pay tomorrow. It's that Steamboat fellow who's prodding them to do it."
"I know they're nervous," said Andy. "As I told the old man yesterday, I was down in that camp car doing a little propaganda stuff, but he couldn't see it."
"I understand," said Quinn warmly.
"I appreciate what you've done, even if he doesn't."
He paused. "If we could only eliminate that Steamboat without scaring the others off, I believe we could hold him. Just now, it looks as if his influence over them was great enough to get them to do what he wants. But if we could get rid of him in the right way, or could overcome his influence in some manner, I believe they'd stay here."
"Have you anything in mind?"
"Oh, I have a little scheme," answered Quinn, "but I'll admit I have my doubts of its success. Anyway, that's my chief reason for coming to see you today."
"Let's hear about it," urged Andy.
"It's just this. We're going to try a little psychology on the steel gangers. Going to pay them in cash tomorrow instead of with a bunch of the usual checks. A bunch of bills in a colored man's hand looks a lot bigger to him than a little slip of paper, even if the paper is worth as much."
"I see," said Peck. "You're figuring that when a man sees all that ready cash in his fist and realizes he can get as much more every 2 weeks if he stays on the job, he's not going to be so ready to leave right off."
"Exactly," said the supervisor.
"You can see for yourself, though, but it's not much to base our hopes on, but we're going to give it a trial."
"How are you going to pay them?" asked Andy.
"That's where you come in," answered Quinn. "We're going to send a special payroll out to you and let you do it."
"But how about the money?" questioned Andy. "Where is it to come from?"
At this question, the attentive Steamboat pricked up his ears.
"That'll come with the payroll sheets," replied Quinn. His words reached Steamboat distinctly. "Sheets and money will be done up in a package and will reach you tonight on number 73. That'll give you a chance to go over it and get things lined up before the men call tomorrow morning. The money will be in bills, about $3,000.
A sort of gentle sigh escaped Steamboat. $3,000. Many, many times the amount that would keep him in comfort, in luxury, over winter. Tomorrow, he'd draw around $40. That $40, plus $7.30, the latter amount almost wholly a result of a recent lucky session at craps, represented his total assets. Steamboat sighed deeply again. $3,000.
he hearkened once more to the conversation within the office. All right, Agent Peck was saying. Let it come. I'll do my best, even though the old man has given me the can. I haven't any safe here, though, to keep the money in overnight, and there's no bank in town. Take it home with you? No, objected Andy. That'd throw me responsible if the stuff should disappear. There was silence for a moment. Then Quinn spoke. In that case, then, I expect the only thing to do will be to conceal it in some place here in the office. It ought to be safe enough, especially as no one else needs to know it's here. It ought to be, assented Andy. Anyway, that's what I'll have to do. Sure it'll be all right, said Quinn. He walked toward the door. Well, I'll have to be moving along. Hasn't been any trouble since last payday, has there? Men behaving? No, no trouble since, replied Andy. The colored boys are doing as well as could be expected, I guess. Just what did happen last time, asked Quinn. I never did hear precisely, and I've been wanting to ask you. Trouble with the town folk, wasn't it? Yes. A few of the steel gangers got a little too much gin and made some excitement uptown. I wasn't there myself, but the next day I heard there'd been threats made. Some of the white folks were coming down here and cleaning out the camp cars. I heard they claimed they'd do it again if the colored men started anything again. That's the deuce of it. When they get a little booze, said Quinn. Well, let's trust they'll behave. But if anything should break loose, you wire to headquarters, and we'll get some of our railroad cops out here quick. A man can't fool with that sort of thing. No telling. All right, responded Andy. But I guess there's not much danger. Mostly hot air, I expect. Hope so, said the supervisor. But don't take any chances. So long. I'll drop in tomorrow and see how things are working out.
It was shortly after dark Friday evening when Andy Peck stepped around the end of the station to get the baggage truck there and pull it out to the front, ready for number 73's arrival. Loud laughter and singing came from most of the camp cars that stood on the siding west of the station. The car that stood nearest to the depot was that wherein Steamboat Jackson and some of his special cronies abode. Andy paused and listened for a few moments. From this last car came the loudest of the sounds, and the sounds were neither those of laughter nor singing. High, declamatory voices sounded there, and the words that floated out were plentifully besprinkled with oaths. A voice came from the rear corner of the station close at hand.
Mr. Agent.
Yes, answered Andy. The voice, though low-pitched, was unmistakably that of Memphis Joe. What is it, Memphis?
Step over here, please. I don't want none of them or the steel gang to see me talking to you.
Wondering, Andy moved over into the gloom of the corner. What's the matter, Memphis?
Mr. Agent, I don't like the way that steamboat man is acting.
Memphis spoke with swift earnestness.
He's done got several bottles of gin somewheres, and he's been setting up the drinks to that crowd of his up in his camp car. They all certainly been talking high and free this last hour or two. I've been listening.
I was trying to hear them myself just now, said Peck. What are they talking about, Memphis? You know?
They's aiming to make big trouble, Mr. Agent, and that's a fact. Some folks, white and colored, bound to get hurt if steamboats crowd do what they's blowing.
And what's next?
What I told you last night, like Steamboat and his gang done up Scanlon's last payday. They's blowing, they's going back up there tonight and make the town folks stand round.
You don't say, exclaimed Andy. But do you think they'll really try it?
Memphis spoke with conviction. They got a lot of gin in them, he declared. And some colored folks, like, will do most anything when they gets the booze. They'll try it, that's certain.
That's bad, said Andy, frowning in the darkness.
Yes, sir, affirmed Memphis. Gonna make big trouble. A lot of us color folks what don't want no trouble. We and Steamboat and his crowd goes uptown. Folks there, most likely they'll chase him back down here to the camp cars. Then there'll be a mix, all colored folks look alike.
By Jove, Memphis, ejaculated Andy. I believe you're not far wrong. First thing we know, there'll be a race war on.
Yes, sir. That's just what I figure. But I's not said nothing yet to nobody but you. Can't some of you stop Steamboat and his bunch?
No, sir, boss. I's afraid not.
Ain't no colored man going to tackle Steamboat. Not no time, and least of all when he's drinking.
The door of Steamboat's car was flung open while Andy stood considering, and a broad beam of light shone out.
A roaring voice, Steamboat's, reached them.
I's not going to allow nobody interfere in my business. As I. If I want to go up and buy me a little drink, that's my business. And ain't no white folks going to stop me. Can't nobody.
The door was slammed shut again, and the roaring voice and the howls of approval were partially shut off. Andy looked around to where Memphis Joe had been standing, but Memphis Joe was moving away, a deeper shadow in the shadows that lay along the side of the depot. That roaring voice obviously had been too much for his nerves.
Memphis!
Called the agent, but Memphis paused not.
You do what you can, Mr. Agent.
The words floated back from the retreating steel ganger pleadingly.
Might be you could call the company for help.
Memphis Joe faded around the far corner of the building and was gone. Andy worried and perplexed, hauled the truck out to the front of the station, and then entered his office. He went to the key of the train wire and called Dispatcher Potts, whose office was at Wharton.
Some of the steel gang men are threatening to make trouble tonight, he said when the dispatcher had answered his call. Could you get some police officers out here soon?
Why?
Yes. Likely, replied Potts. What seems to be the matter, Andy?
They got some booze and are showing signs of going on the warpath. Liable to be a battle on between them and the town folk if things are not stopped.
The devil, said the dispatcher, plainly aroused. Stick there a few minutes and I'll call you.
Peck waited impatiently. It was 5 minutes before the dispatcher called.
Captain Caney of our police force was still in his office, spelled Potts.
He's gathering up several of his men, and they'll leave here on a special, likely a light engine, inside of 10 or 15 minutes. That means they should get to Bellum inside of 45 minutes.
Good, said Andy. They'll be needed.
We got hold of Superintendent Carrick and Supervisor Quinn, too. They'll be on the special. No actual trouble yet, is there?
Peck held the key open a few seconds, so Carrick was coming. He wondered if the superintendent still considered what the steel gang did as none of his, Andy's, affair. He thought of Ina and his spoiled wedding day, and his jaw set grimly. When he came, the old man better not say much, or he might hear something. He tapped the key again.
No, he said to Potts, but it's liable to break soon, judging by the signs. Tell him to hit the ball.
They sure will. Hold the gang down if you can. Till they come, and keep me posted as much as possible.
I will, promised Andy.
Goodbye. Here comes 73.
He dashed out of the station as the train drew in and pulled his truck up to the express car door. Several small boxes of express matter were unloaded, and then the messenger handed Peck a sealed package.
Here's a package the Wharton people told me to be sure to get to you tonight, said the man in the express car.
Sign here.
Andy signed the messenger's book, and the train departed. He ran the truck around the station, dumped the boxes into the ware room, and then re-entered the office, the sealed package under his arm. It was, he knew, the package containing the payroll sheets and the money with which the steel gang was to be paid. As Andy entered the office, an unseen pair of eager eyes outside watched him closely through the rear office window. The furtive, glistening eyes saw the agent place the package on his desk and examine it for a moment. But the agent's next move was not so pleasing. Stepping to the front of the office, Peck pulled down the shades of the two windows there and then moved to one rear window and pulled down that shade. The silent watcher in the darkness outside moved back as Peck approached the last window, and he muttered in disappointment as the blind was lowered. Fortune, though, seemed to favor him, for near the bottom, there was a small slit in the worn, threadbare shade. Quickly, the watcher applied an eye opposite the slit. He muttered triumphantly. He could see in. The shades drawn, Peck approached the stationery cupboard that stood against the wall at one side of the office, opened the doors of it, and from a shelf took a stack of large envelopes. Next he took the sealed package, shoved it to the back of the shelf, and replaced the envelopes where they had been. He closed the cupboard doors. That done, Andy glanced at the office clock. It had been 8:05 when he talked to the dispatcher. It was 8:20 now. The special should be on its way. He went to the key and called. "Has the special started?" he asked Potts. "Just pulled out," answered the man who ran the trains. "Things all right yet?" "Yes, as far as I know," replied Andy. "I'm going uptown now and see how affairs are developing. We'll try to get back here soon and report." There was a perfect buzz of excitement around Scanlan's hotel as Andy Peck drew near. The hotel stood on the main street between the post office and a general store, and was several squares from the depot. The bar room was a long room at one side of the building. On the street corners nearby, different small groups of Bellum citizens stood, talking low and seriously, and eyeing the windows of the saloon. As Peck approached the side door of the barroom, the door was pushed open from the outside, and a man went in. Steamboat. Andy was a little surprised, because he had supposed that Steamboat and his club were already all within. The camp car had been dark and silent when he left the station. He stepped to the door himself, pushed it, opened an inch or so, and put an eye to the opening. Standing, lined up along one end of the bar, were half a dozen of Steamboat's fellow steel gangers. Steamboat was just joining him, and they were greeting him with noisy sallies. At the other end of the bar stood Big Noonan, an oil well driller, and Bellum's cock of the walk. Near him stood five or six other town men, all of them watching the steel gangers and muttering to one another, their faces frowning, their eyes unfriendly. In back of the bar was Scanlan's barkeeper, plainly ill at ease. "Give us all a little old drink of gin, white man," called Steamboat to the barkeeper. The words, as he uttered them, were deliberately offensive. There was a slur to them, an innuendo on the white man. The barkeeper hesitated, glancing at the frowning faces of Big Noonan and his men. Steamboat swaggered closer to the bar. "Step long, white man," he said loudly. "What you afraid about?" The barkeeper's face flushed. He took up a bottle from the array behind him. Andy tarried no longer at the door. He let it swing to, went around to the front, and entered the hotel office. From an inner room, Proprietor Scanlan himself entered the office as Peck stepped in. His face was anxious. Its ruddy glow was a shade paler than usual.
"Scanlan!" exclaimed Peck.
"Just the man I want. You must refuse to give these colored men out there any more booze." He jerked his thumb toward the door that led from the office into the barroom. Scanlan shook his head. "I'd like to, Peck, but I'm more afraid to refuse them than to give it to them. They've been acting ugly ever since they came in." "But they'll only get worse if you keep on with the stuff," remonstrated Peck. "First thing you know, there'll be a riot on. Remember how it started before?" "I know," exclaimed Scanlan. He threw up his hands. "But I can't—" A shout interrupted him, a shout that came from the barroom. Mingled with it was the crash of breaking glass. Then a roar arose, deeper shouts, and the sound of shattering glass was redoubled. "My!" cried Scanlan. "Listen to that!" Andy leaped for the barroom door and swung it open, Scanlan close behind. The barroom was filled with the furious clashing of bodies. All the lights, save a single one above the bar, were out, smashed to bits. Fists thrashed about. Vigorous, profane phrases were uttered aloud. And then, in a second, something flew through the air. There was another crash, and the one remaining light vanished.
"Come on, boys," called Big Noonan's voice. "Come on, get outside. Everybody, go get his gun. We'll go down and clean this black camp car bunch out right."
A yell of approval came from what must have been the white belligerents. There was a rush in the darkened room, and the outer side door burst open. The sound of swiftly moving feet came to the tense Andy and Proprietor Scanlan. Apparently the steel gangers had followed the Bellum citizens out, for the barroom became silent. Then, before Peck or Scanlan had moved, the barkeeper appeared, his face white. "What started it?" demanded Scanlan, seizing the man's shoulder.
"That nigger,"
That steamboat tried to shove Big Noonan aside and called him a name, stumbled the frightened barkeeper. Then Noonan landed on him, and they all waded in. That was enough for Andy. He waited to hear no more. Things, he felt, were moving too swiftly for him to control. He ran out of the office, down the street, popped into a side alley, and legged it for the depot. He saw men running. Cries carried to him. Some of the shouts, he thought, sounded as if they were coming from steamboats. Crowd. Defiant cries. He ran his best. There was confusion around the camp cars as Peck neared the station. High-pitched chatter. Figures flitting in and out of the doors. Andy avoided the cars and came to the depot. Quickly, he unlocked the waiting room door, entered and snapped the lock again behind him, entered the office and closed that door also. Upon leaving, he had turned off all the inside station lights. Now he did not relight them. He had raised the shades before departing, and a platform light just outside shone through the front office windows, making enough light for him to find his way about in the familiar office. He opened the train wire key. "She's broke," he said to the dispatcher. "The fight is on. Started uptown and is working this way fast. How's the special coming?" "She's getting along," replied Potts quickly. "Ought to show up there inside of 10 minutes. If she doesn't do better than that, she's liable to find nothing but pieces left," said Andy. "She's rolling," assured the dispatcher. "Anybody hurt?" "Can't tell." "Hope not," answered Peck. He paused as a sudden fusillade of shots rang out somewhere up around the camp cars. "They're shooting now," he said to Potts. "They are," flashed the dispatcher. "Are you in any danger yourself, boy?" "Guess not," lied Andy, and he smiled a little. He had heard several things plunk against the station right after the volley of shots. The marksmen were shooting high and wild and hitting the depot. "Watch yourself," began Potts, and that was as far as Andy paid any attention to what the dispatcher was saying. There was a sudden crash at the rear window of the office. Glass flew in a shower over the office door. "Hokey," breathed Andy, and at once dropped to the floor, crouching down in the obscurity and protection of the corner at the end of the telegraph desks. Several lesser crashes followed at the window, as if something were being used to knock out the ragged pieces of glass left sticking there after the first blow. Then a black blur abruptly appeared between the broken sashes, and a figure dropped quickly inside the office. A faint ray of light from the platform lamp outside fell on the intruder's face. Steamboat Jackson. The agent crouched lower in his corner, astonished but silent. Without an instant's delay, Steamboat moved toward the stationery cupboard. He jerked the doors open, reached in, and pulled out the bunch of big envelopes. He reached in again, brought out something else, and laid it on the edge of the ticket window, close beside the cupboard. Dark as the office was, the agent knew what the colored man had placed on the window ledge. It was the package of payroll money! A sort of savage ejaculation of pleasure came from the steel gang man as he put down the package of money. But he did not linger over his rejoicing. From the cupboard, then, he quickly pulled out envelopes, tissue sheets, and various sizes of paper forms. These he pulled apart swiftly and piled on the floor in a heap about the corner of the wooden cupboard. There was the scratching of a match, and a little burst of flame flared up. Steamboat reached down and touched the flame to the edge of a sheet of paper in the heap that he had made. Steamboat's back, as he stood at the cupboard, had been turned to Andy Peck. The agent's amazement at the colored man's interest had only increased by his further surprise at Steamboat's bringing forth of the money, by his surprise that the man should have knowledge of it and of its hiding place. And then, as Steamboat piled the paper on the floor, some flash of explanation came to Andy, some perception of Steamboat's true reason for inciting the riot. If Steamboat had started the trouble payday night after receiving his wages, the agent would not have been so perplexed. Andy had wondered, though, why the fellow had cut loose tonight, the night before payday, but now he knew. Up around the camp cars, the shouts had risen in volume, but so far there had been no repetition of the shooting. A steamboat struck the match and bent forward. Andy Peck, silent as a cat, rose on the balls of his feet. As the match flame was touched to the paper, he grabbed his stout-legged office chair from the floor beside him and swung in the air. "You treacherous devil!" cried Andy and brought the chair down on Steamboat's head. The blow was true, but the colored man's head was also true to type. The steel ganger staggered erect as the swiftly spreading flame on the floor lit up the office. Surprised and slightly bewildered he was, but his eyes flashed wickedly as he faced the agent.
"I'll tear your heart out,"
he roared and made a lunge at Peck.
"Try it,"
invited Andy, swinging his chair again. And this time he didn't aim at the head. He aimed a smashing, sidewise blow at the black man's shins. Steamboat's legs were swept from under him like straws. He fell to the floor with a tremendous thump, his howls filling the office.
"Oh, Pimp Gaimo! Don't do that! Don't do that no more, Mr. Agent!"
Agent Andy, chair poised again, held back.
"Will you be good?" he demanded.
"Yes, sir. Yes, sir," groaned Steamboat. "Only just don't hit my legs no more."
There was an abrupt grinding of brakes out in front of the office before Andy could say more and a hissing of steam. Unperceived, the special had arrived. A light engine. The waiting room door flew open with a crash as stout shoulders were set against the lock's resistance. There was a tramping of heavy feet inside. Andy flung open the office door. Carrick, Quinn, Captain Caney, and three other men swept in, flashlights and pistols in hand.
"Peck!" cried the superintendent, amazed at the sight in the office. "What in the devil? What's this fire?"
"We saw it through the window."
But Peck was all business. He had a plan in mind.
"Watch that man on the floor," he exclaimed. "Grab him up and make him walk."
Without further ado, he snatched up the office water bucket and dashed its contents on the burning heap of paper. The fire by that time had been licking eagerly at the stationery case, but the water was sufficient. The flames abruptly expired.
"Come along, we got to hurry," cried Andy then.
He grabbed up the package of payroll money from the ticket window ledge and thrust it into Quinn's hands. "Hang on to that," he said. Captain Caney, meanwhile, had hauled the abject steamboat to his feet. Peck clutched the colored man's other arm. Pushing and tugging, he started for the door. Amazed and not comprehending, they seemed all to recognize Andy's leadership. In a group, they burst out of the station and headed towards the nearby camp cars. Caney and Peck in the lead, dragging the reluctant steel ganger with them.
"What's the idea?" grunted Caney as they stumbled on. "What are you working at?"
"Wait," panted Andy. "Not time now to explain. Have to get this thing headed off before someone gets killed, if someone hasn't already been. You just follow my lead and back me up." The moon had come up since Andy's hasty return to the office from uptown, revealing the camp cars and surroundings clearly as the party approached. All lights in the cars were out now, the car's occupants lurking in the obscurity inside. As the party rounded the end of the string of cars, the Bellum citizens gathered in the shadow of a warehouse at the head of the siding. Apparently mistook them for charging steel gangers.
A shout arose. "Here they come, boys!"
was Big Noonan's voice.
"Out and at them!"
There was a mighty shout in answer, and the Bellumites leaped out for battle. From Steamboat's darkened car, an answering cry went forth, and some shots flashed out. Andy Peck dropped Steamboat's arm and jumped ahead of his party.
"Keep back, men," he shouted to the oncoming townfolk. "Keep them back, Noonan. Everything's all right now."
The Bellumites recognized Peck's voice, and perceiving their mistake as to the party's identity, faltered and came to a halt. Only Noonan pressed forward.
"What?" he cried. "That you, Andy?"
"Yes," replied the agent. "Just hold your men for a minute. I'm going to fix things." He turned and grasped Steamboat by the arm. "Tell your men in the car to let up," he commanded sternly. "Tell them to come out here quick." Steamboat, overawed, did not demur. He faced his car.
"Come on now, Joe," he called dejectedly. "Come on, you and all the boys." "For the land's sake, is that you, Steamboat?"
said one in the car, evidently Joe. His head was cautiously sticking out an open window.
"We all been wondering where you been."
"It's me,"
admitted the gloomy Steamboat.
"You'll not be harmed," put in Peck to the men in the car.
"And when you get out here, I'll tell you where Steamboat's been." From the car next to Steamboat's, a voice now spoke. Memphis Joe's voice, coming from the doorway.
"And that's you, Mr. Agent?"
"It is," answered Andy. "Get the boys all out, Memphis, and bring them here. Nobody will get hurt."
A joyous whoop came from Memphis, and in a second, he and the other men in his car stumbled out, arriving on the ground as soon as Steamboat's crowd. From other cars, stereo gangers did likewise. Whooping as the word spread. They gathered together near where Andy, Carrick, Quinn, Steamboat, Caney, and the other officers stood. Quietly now, perceiving that some strange thing was happening, the Bellum men and Big Noonan edged nearer, lining up on one side of the agent and his party, while the colored men lined up on the other. "You men have been easy marks. Suckers," said Andy, addressing himself, particularly to Steamboat's wondering, rather sheepish-looking half-dozen. "Steamboat's been making you play tricks for him. Tricks so he'd get the good things and you'd get nothing. Did you know that, George?"
What you all mean?" nervously said George, a tall, rangy buck.
"Why, as you know, Steamboat's been blowing. He was going south this winter with a pocket full of money, but he hadn't got his pocket full. Today, though, he must have learned some way that I was expecting a package of cash in this evening's train. He decided that was just the cash he wanted. So he got some booze, managed to get you fellows worked up, and finally got a good-looking riot started. Then while you men did the fighting, he sneaked down to the station, broke in, found the money, and tried to set the station on fire. The fire would have been blamed on the riot, see, and his theft of the money would be covered up. So I happened to be in the station, and Steamboat came to grief. A stir, as of resentment, was visible among the half-dozen.
"Lord say, Steamboat," said George. "Isn't that right?"
But Steamboat made no answer. He merely hung his head and mumbled unintelligibly. "Sure it's right," declared Andy. "Look at him, and you can tell for yourselves. And of course, you don't know what the money Steamboat tried to swipe was for, do you, George?"
"No, sir," answered George.
"Well, I'll tell you. It's pay money. That's to be used to pay the Steel Gang men tomorrow. That's the kind of man Steamboat is. He was going to take it all, and you fellows wouldn't have gotten any. Not tomorrow, anyway. You'd have had to wait several days longer until another payroll was fixed up." This time the wave of resentment that swept over the Steel Gang was not confined to the men from Steamboat's car. It went over the entire crowd, and there was a muttering of imprecations and threats. Seeing their bad man subdued, the rest of the gang felt emboldened. But Andy had turned away from them for a moment. He faced Big Noonan and the Bellum men. "See how it is, Noonan?" he said. "This Steamboat man here is really the only one to blame, and we'll get rid of him. He brought it on a few others for the reasons I just gave, but most of these colored men don't want any trouble. One of them came to me just before train time tonight, said he was afraid Steamboat was trying to stir up something, and asked me to do what I could to stop it." "I'd say you did what you could," boomed Big Noonan. "You certainly stopped it." "Hooray for Andy," called several of the Bellum citizens behind Noonan. And three cheers were given exuberantly, and then, to the embarrassed agent's confusion, they were echoed by the Steel Gang side. But Agent Andy kept his wits. He faced the colored men again. "And now that this fuss is over, and you're going to get your money tomorrow, the railroad wants all you men to stay," he cried. "All but Steamboat. It's he that's been making all the trouble, filling you full of lies about the cold weather and trying to scare you out, just out of pure devilishness. You stick with the railroad, and they'll see that you're kept warm. Get lots of coal and plenty to eat. Here are the big bosses, the superintendent and the supervisor. They'll tell you the same." Andy turned to the big bosses. "How about it, gentlemen?" he said. He looked at Quinn, and then he looked at Carrick. When he looked at Carrick, Andy's eyes were a little defiant. But the superintendent was not slow to respond. "That's right," he affirmed loudly. "What the agent said goes. We'll take care of you. It's a promise. Will you stay?" There was a half-instant's hesitation. Then Memphis Joe spoke.
"Yes, sir," he shouted. "I's a-gonna stay. We're all gonna stay. What y'all say, big boys?"
He turned to his fellows, and a great shout of affirmation greeted him.
"Gonna stay," roared the Steel Gang. "Gonna stay."
"That's the stuff," called Carrick enthusiastically. "We'll count on you, every one." He faced about to where Andy Peck stood, and then, for the first time in his life, so far as any man there knew, he openly confessed to an error.
"Son," said Carrick quietly, "I've made a mistake.
I'm just beginning to get an idea of what you've done here for us."
And, if I'm not too late, I want to ask you to forget what I said the other day. Forget it and stay here on this job. Will you do it?
Andy could scarcely believe his ears. Somehow, the possibility of anything like this had never occurred to him. For a moment, the thought swept through his head that there was a most excellent opportunity to say something that would scorch Carrick's hide. But consideration of Ina and knowledge of what his staying would mean to her and to him checked his tongue, if not a certain sense of whimsicality that always was lurking at the back of his brain.
"I'll be so pleased," he murmured.
It was someone less than 10 minutes after he had given the superintendent his answer that Andy came to the residence of Duncan, the miller. He was about to press the bell when the door flew open, and Ina came out, apparently bound for somewhere in great haste. She abruptly stopped at the sight of him.
"Andy!" she exclaimed. "I've been so worried and afraid. All that noise and shooting. I was just going out to hunt you."
"You needn't now," he said, his face beaming. "I'm here."
Is everything all right?"
she questioned, seeming a little puzzled at his very obvious joy.
"All right. I guess,
yes." He seized her in his arms. "We're going to have our little bungalow after all, little girl."
"Andy!"
"Yes, indeed," he cried. "Old man Carrick is going to keep me on the job."
"And?"
But that was as far as he got just then, for reasons that may be surmised.
You just heard Agent Andy by Russell A. Boggs, read by Tim Maroney. And on this marvelous first day of a new year, we at Protecting Project Pulp want to wish you and yours a most splendid new year. This thing only happens once a year, and it's a marvelous opportunity to chart a new course and turn your boots towards some unexplored territory. Because, you know, when you step off that beaten track, that is when real adventures start happening. Protecting Project Pulp is brought to you by Fred Heimbaugh, our keen-eyed and intrepid assistant editor, Tom O'Dwyer, our acoustically adroit sound engineer, and Tony C. Smith, the visionary producer and editor of this and all the podcasts in the astonishing District of Wonders network. You can subscribe to Protecting Project Pulp on iTunes or on our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com. We hope you enjoyed this week's tale. Next week, it won't be the winter that puts a chill in your bones. It'll be a chilling ghost tale by Lawrence Donovan titled Whispering Death. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Robison, wishing you nothing but the finest adventures. I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.